KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. We have glimpses of the immigration crackdown. Oklahoma leaders welcome federal action but disagree about agents in schools. Agents went after gangs in Colorado but found few gang members. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Five counties around Lubbock, Texas, face an outbreak of measles. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Stevens. We have an update this morning on the effort to contain a disease that seemed to be eradicated a generation ago. Also, an employee of the Department of Energy tells of being fired after 2 months on the job. And Germany's economy is stagnant just before an election focused on the economy. It's Wednesday, February 19th. This day in 1945, U.S. Marines landed on the island of Iwo Jima, and Marines famously raised the flag there a few days later. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Russia says Washington and Moscow are on their way toward normalizing relations. That follows yesterday's talks in Saudi Arabia. It was the first direct high-level exchange between the two countries since Russia invaded Ukraine nearly 3 years ago. NPR's Charles Maines reports the talks mark an abrupt shift in U.S. policy.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, briefing Russian lawmakers on the Saudi talks, praised President Trump as the first Western leader to publicly acknowledge the prospect of NATO expansion into Ukraine as a major cause of the war. Lavrov said there was now a shared desire not only to end that conflict, but possibly work with the U.S. to develop new trade and geopolitical partnerships. To do that, Lavrov said both sides first had to, quote, clean up Biden administration efforts to undermine relations. The Biden White House sought to isolate Russia over its invasion of its neighbor. In contrast, President Trump said he wants to work with Russia to end the war, unnerving Ukraine and traditional U.S. allies in Europe. Charles Maines, NPR News.
Frigid temperatures are blanketing the central U.S. National Weather Service meteorologist Andrew Orison says millions of people are under extreme cold warnings.
We have temperatures up across the Northern Plains region that are on the order of minus 30 to minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. The Dakotas, parts of Montana, on down into Nebraska, but it's very cold all the way south down into Texas. Some parts of Texas, especially northern Texas, the temperatures are in the single digits, and there's actually a few sub-zero temperatures there.
There are also winter storm warnings in several Appalachian states. Stocks opened lower this morning as the Commerce Department reported a sharper-than-expected drop in home construction last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 140 points in early trading.
It's hard to break ground on new houses when much of the ground is frozen. Housing starts fell nearly 10% last month as frigid winter weather blanketed much of the country. Permits for future home construction tell a somewhat warmer story. They showed little change from December. President Trump's pick to run the Commerce Department has won Senate confirmation on a narrow party line vote. As Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick will oversee a sprawling department that includes the National Weather Service and the Census Bureau, which counts things like housing starts. The former Wall Street executive will also enforce the president's trade agenda, including tariffs. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump's choice to be labor secretary will appear this morning for her confirmation hearing. Former Oregon Congresswoman Lori Chavez de Remer drew strong labor support while in office. Her nomination has been praised by the head of the Teamsters Union. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are now down 150 points. You're listening to NPR. Demonstrators gathered at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention headquarters in Atlanta yesterday. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Sophie Gratas reports they were protesting the firing of thousands of workers in federal health agencies.
The CDC has lost about 10% of its workforce, more than 1,000 people, since termination letters went out across the Department of Health and Human Services last week. Barbara Stanky, retired from state public health, says that the cuts will leave frontline workers without critical guidance.
The CDC is sponsoring that. You know, they're the ones who coordinate that. It takes a lot. It takes a lot to get from federal to state to local, to the people and communities.
And those communities need good information, she says, to fight infectious and chronic diseases. For NPR News, I'm Sophie Gradas in Atlanta.
The Vatican says Pope Francis continues to rest in a Rome hospital. He's now been diagnosed with a severe case of pneumonia. The Pope was initially hospitalized last week for the treatment of bronchitis. Pakistani officials have increased the number of arrests of Afghan citizens who are in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. More arrests have been reported in a nearby city. The Afghan embassy in Islamabad claims that Pakistan is trying to expel all Afghan refugees from the country. Pakistan denies this, but Pakistani leaders have previously vowed to eject Afghan nationals. The Associated Press reports more than a million Afghans are now living in Pakistan after they fled the Taliban takeover of their country. Many are seeking resettlement in the U.S. It's NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, a stagnant economy in Germany has politicians rethinking the country's economic model.
But first, immigration officers are falling short of President Trump's expectations for mass detentions and deportations of people in the U.S. without legal status, even though arrests are up compared to daily averages during the Biden administration. We're going to take the pulse now from two parts of the country, starting with Lionel Ramos of member station KOSU in Oklahoma City.
The quiet churn of an office printer is the sound of one Oklahoma community preparing for the worst. Last month, hundreds of people in South Oklahoma City's predominantly Latino immigrant community attended a legal clinic hosted by the local Latino Legislative Caucus.
And so we've got 25 stations here with volunteers, mostly college and law students.
That's State Senator Michael Brooks. He leads the Latino Caucus and is also an immigration attorney. In all, Brooks said volunteers helped more than 350 people without legal status plan for the possibility that federal immigration agents could detain and deport them. People such as Elena Rios. She's a local public school janitor and a single mother of five. The 40-year-old says she fled Mexico after losing her husband to violence and has been in the U.S. without legal status for about 6 years. She says the Trump administration's crackdown has her in a panic.
First, you get stressed out, and then you start to become desperate because you come here for something better for your children, only to find yourself stumbling again like this.
She's looking to assign temporary guardianship of her children to someone in case she is detained. It's still unclear the degree to which the number of federal immigration arrests and detentions is up in Oklahoma. Republican Governor Kevin Stitt launched Operation Guardian in November, focusing on the 500-plus incarcerated individuals without legal status in the state's prison system. It also calls for a federal partnership aimed at deputizing state agents to carry out immigration enforcement. Meanwhile, Oklahoma State School Superintendent Ryan Walters says he wants to allow federal authorities into schools to detain students whose parents are already in the custody of immigration authorities.
That's what President Trump sees fit, as there's illegal immigrant population there that needs to have enforcement to remove them from the schools. Absolutely, we will work with him to make sure that he's able to carry that out.
Plucking children out of schools, Superintendent Walters says, is about keeping families together. But Governor Stitt, who supports getting tough on migrant criminals, says the school idea goes too far. Stitt said using children as, quote, political pawns does not help public safety. For NPR News, I'm Lionel Ramos in Oklahoma City.
And I'm Allison Sherry in Denver. In Colorado, there is a state law that prohibits county and local police officers from taking part in immigration enforcement. So ICE here has had to rely on federal officers. And since Trump's inauguration, those officers have depicted these immigration raids as vital to public safety. So they say they're going in to bust drug dealers. They use flash grenades and battering rams. They detain a bunch of people.
All right, we're here today to conduct an at-large enforcement operation looking for Trenda Agua, the gang members here from Venezuela. I want to thank our interagency partners. We've got U.S. Marshals, we've got FBI, we've got DEA.
That's ICE's acting director, Caleb Vitello, who came to the Denver suburb of Aurora recently for a large-scale immigration action with an array of federal officers.
One goal was clearly achieved, creating fear and uncertainty in immigrant communities that deportations could happen at any time.
But despite local and national TV cameras and big military-style vehicles and warrants signed by judges, most of the people picked up in these raids have yet to be charged with any federal crimes. In Aurora, federal agents ended up detaining about 30 people, and only one was a gang member, according to the president's border czar, Tom Homan. He told Fox News that the action wasn't very successful because someone leaked the information to the media.
This is serious business, and they need to stop or we won't prosecute them to the Department of Justice.
Since January, only a few of those rounded up have faced federal criminal charges. Not for serious drug or gun crimes, but for reentering the country after being deported, which is usually a misdemeanor. Laura Lunn is an attorney who advocates for detainees at ICE facilities.
I've been doing this work for 14 years. Never have I seen a case where a judge signed a warrant to go pick up somebody who's being charged with illegal reentry where their front door is blown off of the hinges.
Because federal authorities haven't been transparent about who they've detained, it's been impossible to verify whether the people in custody have criminal records. At least three people in the country with work authorizations from Mauritania were swept up in these sweeps, according to lawyers and family members. Mamadou Ja knows the three detained. He says all three were seeking asylum and were on their way to work.
Peaceful people who's not committing any crime here, like seek freedom that this country has to give if they were picked up without any charges.
Advocates call this raids without records because there's been little to no information about who's in detention, what the warrants are for, or whether those in custody even had a criminal background. For NPR News, I'm Allison Sherry in Denver.
Okay, to unpack what we just heard, we're joined by NPR's Joel Rose, who covers immigration. Hey, Joel.
Hey, Layla.
Okay, so both of those reports suggest that President Trump's immigration crackdown is running into some challenges.
Yeah, now it is only a month into the administration, right?
Right.
I should say that first. But so far, we have seen some gaps between the narrative that the administration is pushing and the reality on the ground. The narrative is that the president is delivering on his campaign promise to build the biggest mass deportation operation in U.S. history. Here is part of a TV ad released this week by the Department of Homeland Security featuring Secretary Kristi Noem.
President Trump has a clear message for those that are in our country illegally. Leave now. If you don't, we will find you and we will deport you. You will never return.
But the reality in recent weeks is that ICE has not been able to deliver the arrest numbers that the White House wants.
Okay.
Trump officials say they want to see 1,200 to 1,500 arrests per day at a minimum. And for a while in January, ICE was publishing numbers every day that showed it was nearly reaching those goals. But according to data published by DHS, that number dipped at the end of January to fewer than 1,000 per day. And in the first week of February, it was below 600 per day. And we are seeing some frustration about that from the administration.
So what do we know about who the administration's arresting?
Not a lot. The White House says it has been focused on arresting immigrants with criminal records. But the administration has released virtually no information about the people, for example, that it sent to the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, including their names. So it's virtually impossible to verify those claims.
NPR's Joel Rose. Thank you, Joel.
You're welcome.
Europe's biggest economy is in trouble. In Germany, there's too little investment, too much bureaucracy, and of course a war nearby, and all those things have slowed down an economy that thrived during the boom years of globalization. The economy is a big issue in Germany's upcoming elections. NPR's Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
Robotic arms spin copper wiring faster than the eye can track it on a factory floor in the Bavarian city of Memmingen. Each year, this factory produces tens of millions of solenoids, electromagnets used in automotive and industrial machinery. But that's down 20% from just 5 years ago. Owner Albert Schultz remembers those days fondly.
Germany has had a fantastic party now for 20 years. Globalization, great for us. Everybody wanted our products, yeah? They were cheap, thanks to the euro. Energy supplies from Russia were cheap. And you Americans secured our military security, yes? Thanks for that.
But these economic advantages that Germany enjoyed for years are on their way out.
Globalization is in retreat. Chinese want to produce for themselves, Americans want to produce for themselves. The euro is still there, okay. We have to take care of our own military now, and the cheap energy supplies from Russia are gone as well. So this party has ended.
Schultz says among European economies, Germany has profited the most from globalization in the past two decades, and that is why it's suffering the most from globalization's decline. Schultz says it's hurt his company too.
We have been in crisis mode for 5 or 6 years now. There's been no growth since 2019, and profits have gone constantly down, and currently there are no profits.
Schultz is not alone. The whole of German industry has shed hundreds of thousands of jobs since the end of the pandemic and the start of Russia's war in Ukraine, a topic that was center stage in the most recent debate between current Chancellor Olaf Scholz and his likely successor Friedrich Merz of the center-right Christian Democratic Union Party.
Wir sind jetzt im dritten Jahr einer Rezession. Das hat es in Deutschland noch nie gegeben.
Germany's been in a recession for 3 years in a row. That is unprecedented, exclaimed Merz in the debate. You claim deindustrialization is not happening, Mr. Chancellor, said Merz to Scholz. But how is the loss of 300,000 jobs anything but deindustrialization? Merz's answer, should he become chancellor, is to cut bureaucracy and corporate regulation. He's also against calls for a ban on the combustion engine to protect German automakers.
I mean, we were kind of world champions in producing cars, but the cars that we produce are also the cars of the past and not the cars for the future.
Jana Pugliarin heads the Berlin office for the European Council on Foreign Relations. She says German voters are looking for a new economic formula.
So you need to come up with something that is not based on also the old German economic models. I think the export surplus, maybe that is a thing of the past in a world where kind of globalization doesn't work the way we thought it would, where you see more barriers when it comes to free trade and where you see trade also being increasingly politicized.
With new U.S. tariffs and economists predicting a 1% increase in unemployment by the end of this year, and with no sign the recession will lift, Pugliarin says whoever emerges to run the next German government will need to implement some new economic ideas or run the risk of being voted out of office once again. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Memmingen, Bavaria.
This is NPR News. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, Germany's federal elections are on Sunday, and Elon Musk is supporting the far-right candidate for chancellor. As the Trump administration moves America's foreign policy to the right, European leaders are concerned about the future of their alliance with the U.S. We'll talk with Anne Applebaum, who writes about the new authoritarianism. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from National Geographic Lindblad Expeditions, committed to taking travelers deeper into the wonders of planet Earth. Each expedition cruise is guided by a diverse team. natgeoexpeditions.com/cruises. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Measles is spreading across parts of West Texas.
Health officials thought they had eradicated this disease 25 years ago, but it's occasionally returned, most recently to five counties around Lubbock, Texas.
Which is where we find Samantha Larned of our member station KTTZ. Samantha, good morning.
Good morning.
What's it like there?
There is a lot of anxiety around this. In the past week, measles cases have more than doubled. We now have 58 confirmed cases. Here in Lubbock, it's just one, but it's the first one the city has seen in more than 20 years. Zach Holbrooks is the executive director of South Plains Public Health District, which serves Gaines County and Terry County outside of Lubbock, where most of these cases are being reported. He expects cases to continue rising.
Could it grow? Absolutely, it could. We're trying to educate and get as much information out as possible so that people realize what the stakes are.
A majority of the cases are among school-age children, and the state health department says most of the measles patients are either unvaccinated or have an unknown vaccine status. Measles can be dangerous, even deadly, especially for babies and children.
Okay, you mentioned vaccines there. Do health authorities feel they understand how this particular outbreak got going?
Public health officials have described communities in Gaines County as vaccine hesitant. The vaccination rate there is just under 82% as compared to the state of Texas, which has a vaccination rate of 90%. Catherine Wells is the director of public health here in Lubbock, where there is that one case. And she says the process of confirming measles cases is a lot quicker in a city than in those remote rural areas like Seminole, which is an hour and a half away from here, where a majority of those cases have occurred.
The quickest way to get that measles test done is in the state public health lab in Austin, which is fine when you're in Lubbock because we have overnight delivery to Austin.
Okay, I guess she's saying that it's a little bit harder to catch up to this disease and track and isolate it when you're in some of the rural areas. I'd like to know, though, is this outbreak in West Texas representative of things going on around the country?
Well, like Texas, in the past month, there's been cases in Georgia, Rhode Island, New York City, and Alaska. And this is all coming as Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is getting started leading the Health and Human Services Department. Kennedy was critical of the measles vaccine for years before he was nominated. Health officials say the vaccine is 97% effective at preventing measles even after exposure. Some of the people who are at risk are those with compromised immune systems, like pregnant people and babies under 1 year old who can't receive the vaccine. Dr. Ron Cook is the health authority for the city of Lubbock, and he says the vaccine is safe.
I tell my pediatric moms and dads, if they get a rash after the MMR, it's okay. It's not measles. It's just your body's reaction to the vaccine.
There haven't been any deaths so far with this outbreak, but providers are concerned about continued spread from those who might not know that they have measles. And MMR vaccines are available across the state.
Samantha, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Samantha Larned is a reporter with member station KTTZ in Lubbock, Texas.
Now we have one story of thousands of federal workers who've lost their jobs. She's going by Rose, She's 26, and she was hired by the Department of Energy in December.
We're letting Rose use her middle name because she still holds out hope she could work for the federal government again someday and worries she'll be retaliated against for talking about her experience. It all started late last Thursday.
I was winding down for the day, and then all of a sudden, I get a notification ping that I hear on my desk.
A coworker said she needed to check her email right away. She opened it up and found a letter from the Department of Energy telling her she'd been terminated.
DOE finds that your further employment would not be in the public interest.
Rose was shocked, and she had plenty of company. Even longtime workers seemed confused.
People who have been in the federal government 30, 40 years, like, we have never seen this before. This is unprecedented.
And she didn't have much time. Her email was about to be shut off.
I am now scrambling, trying to forward these attachments to myself. I'm also trying to reach out to folks and say my goodbyes and just say thank you for everything. I've had such a lovely experience here.
By 11:30 that night, she'd been locked out of her work email. Rose had to let her family know she'd been fired, including her dad, a military veteran living in Florida.
He's a very big Trump supporter.
In fact, when she'd been hired, she'd had a conversation with him about her new federal job. She joked with him,
if I lose this job, I'm going to pack a toothbrush and put all of my things in a little hobo satchel, and I'm knocking on your door. Little did I know that door would be destroyed later in the Florida hurricanes.
That's right. Her dad's house was destroyed in Hurricanes Helene and Milton, which struck Florida in the fall. For Rose, it's a particularly bitter irony because her job was to try and help develop alternative energy sources.
The work I was doing and supporting was directly relating to climate change, which is why, like, these natural disasters are on the rise, because of climate change.
But Rose doesn't seem angry at her dad. In fact, if anything, she feels closer to him.
I remember I was sitting at a dinner with my dad recently, and he was talking about, like, it feels like we are forgotten. Because as soon as the hurricane in Florida happened, then it was North Carolina, then it was the California wildfires. And there's a relationship between all of this. Federal employees feel forgotten. My dad, who voted for Trump, feels forgotten. Across the board, everybody just feels this sense of loss and just feels like I'm not being heard.
This moment in America feels so much bigger than her and her father, but she doesn't have a lot of time to reflect. She's got to find work.
Bills aren't going to stop because I lost my job. Car payments aren't going to stop because I lost my job. Student loans aren't going to stop because I lost my job.
While searching for a new one, she's thought about parking herself on the sidewalk outside the energy department on the off chance they might take her back. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Ireland may soon pass a bill banning trade with Israeli settlements in the occupied territories.
And in practice, what that would mean is that if you're a supermarket here and you're stocking dates that have been produced in illegal settlements, you'll be asked to pull them from your shelves.
I'm Scott Detrow. How war in the Middle East reverberates in unlikely places. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Senate is expected to hold a confirmation vote on Kash Patel to be director of the FBI before the end of the week. NPR's Giles Snyder says senators have advanced Patel's nomination on a party-line vote.
Kash Patel's nomination to lead the FBI cleared a key procedural hurdle on a 48-45 party line vote, keeping him on track to head the nation's most prominent law enforcement agency. Patel is one of President Trump's most controversial nominees. He is a Trump loyalist who worked as an intelligence and Defense Department official during Trump's first term. A loud critic of the FBI, Patel has proposed closing the Bureau's headquarters and turning it into a museum for the deep state. Democrats say Patel is unfit to lead the FBI. During his confirmation hearing, he sought to put to rest concerns about his independence from Trump, saying he wants to reform the FBI. Troil Snyder, NPR News.
President Trump's special U.S. envoy to Russia and Ukraine says one of the objectives for his visit to Kyiv today is to sit and listen. Keith Kellogg is meeting with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky a day after Secretary of State Marco Rubio and other U.S. officials met with a Russian delegation in Saudi Arabia to talk about ending the war in Ukraine. Officials from Kyiv were not invited. This is NPR News. Before his meeting with Kellogg, Zelensky pushed back on some of President Trump's latest comments. Trump accused Kyiv of starting the war with Russia. Moscow launched the war. Zelensky also accused Trump of spreading Russian disinformation by claiming Zelensky has very little public support in Ukraine. Part of President Trump and Elon Musk's efforts to shrink the federal government includes slashing money for pro-democracy and human rights groups abroad. As NPR's Emily Fang reports, it's giving China another opening to increase its soft power globally.
The slash to foreign assistance aid is a windfall for China, which found the groups the United States funded a nuisance. Groups like legal aid organizations, citizen watchdog groups, and human rights investigation organizations. The groups say few others are willing to fund their dangerous work, and some have been forced to cut staff and projects. Human rights defenders say accusations from Musk that foreign aid is wasteful and funds leftist propaganda echoes the frequent criticism they receive from authoritarian governments. Emily Fang, NPR News.
Winter storm warnings are in effect in areas of Kentucky, West Virginia, Virginia, and North Carolina. The National Weather Service says close to a foot of snow is expected by tonight in areas of Virginia Beach and Norfolk. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at Schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Brazil's former president could be facing a long prison sentence for his participation in what authorities say was an attempt to overturn the country's election in 2022.
Yeah, Brazil's attorney general indicted the far-right former president Jair Bolsonaro, accusing him of plotting a coup to stay in power, as well as inciting violence and even approving a plan to poison the current president.
NPR South America correspondent Kerry Kahn has been following all of this. Kerry, good morning.
Good morning.
Wow, a coup attempt, inciting violence, poisoning. What more can you say about these accusations?
They're stunning charges. The standout points, prosecutors say that Bolsonaro and 33 others, they said it was this vast criminal organization to keep him in power after he narrowly lost to the current president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. On top of that, there was also this outline to poison Lula, kill his vice president and a Supreme Court justice who Bolsonaro has feuded with. The idea was to create this constitutional crisis, and then the military would have to take over to calm any unrest and Bolsonaro would be reinstated. Investigators say they even found a speech that Bolsonaro was to give once he was back in power. In the indictment, the prosecutor said that, quote, the plan was conceived and taken with the knowledge of the president, and he agreed to it.
Well, the draft of the speech, I guess, would be pretty strong evidence. But what has Bolsonaro said about the allegations?
He's always denied them. His defense did release a statement saying that the former president never, ever supported any movement to deconstruct the democratic rule of law in any way and called the charges inept. In a statement to the New York Times, Bolsonaro went further, saying the accusations are, quote, a weaponization of the justice system, and jailing him is a desperate attempt to criminalize his political movement and silence millions of Brazilians. And if you're thinking the comparisons between Bolsonaro's case is similar to President Trump's false claims of the 2020 election being stolen from him, Bolsonaro did that himself. He said the legal fight against him is just like the same strategy used against President Trump, which he pointed out failed. The two men were close allies when Bolsonaro was in power, and supporters of Bolsonaro have been emboldened by Trump's return to power. They've been saying that the U.S. president is even going to help them bring Bolsonaro back, and he's been barred from running for office for at least 8 years.
Hmm. Well, these events took place almost 2 years ago. Had people been waiting for these charges a long time?
Yes, they were. This has been a very lengthy investigation. Late last year, we got a glimpse of the evidence against Bolsonaro when police turned over their investigation to the Attorney General Prosecutor's Office. That report was nearly 900 pages long. It's based on testimonies, phone records, and also plea deals with close allies of Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro's running mate, also charged in the case, has been in custody, as well as other close confidants of his. And there are also hundreds of cases against the rioters who were charged and tried for ransacking the Capitol on January 8th.
Okay, so long investigation, plea deals, 900-page report. Now we have the criminal charges. Where do we go next?
It's now up to the Supreme Court. They will decide whether they will arrest Bolsonaro and put him on trial. You know, such a trial like that could start this year, and it would definitely be an explosive political event in this deeply divided country. And if convicted of the charges, which are quite serious, Bolsonaro's sentence could be anywhere from 12 years to as much as 4 decades, Steve, in prison.
And Pierce Carey Khan, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Pope Francis remains hospitalized for treatment for pneumonia in both lungs. A Vatican spokesman says the Pope slept peacefully overnight and ate breakfast this morning. Despite his illness, the 88-year-old Pope has managed to continue to work, including keeping in touch with the Catholic parish in Gaza, as he has done throughout the war there. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports from Rome.
Father Gabriel Romanelli says in an interview posted on Vatican News that Pope Francis has called from hospital at the same time he always calls. Even though there was a power blackout in Gaza, he says, the Pope kept trying to get through until he was able to speak with the parishioners in a video call and send everyone there his blessings. The Pope has maintained near daily contact with leaders in the Catholic Church in Gaza throughout the recent war between Israel and Hamas that has killed at least 48,000 Palestinians. Father Romanelli says the Pope had sounded a little more tired than usual when he rang from hospital, and that the Pope had acknowledged that he needed to take care of himself. The 88-year-old pontiff has been suffering from a respiratory infection for more than a week and has been in hospital for several days.
Invece ieri domenica mi ha inviato un messaggio scritto.
Romanelli says on Sunday the Pope texted him instead of calling and thanked him for all the prayers he was receiving from Gaza. The Vatican said today that doctors are now describing the Pope's condition as a, quote, complex clinical situation. It said in a press release that a chest scan demonstrates the onset of bilateral pneumonia. As a young adult, Pope Francis had part of one lung removed after he developed pleurisy. The Vatican says, despite these challenges, the Pope remains in a good mood and continues to pray.
total.
On a scratchy phone line from Gaza, George Anton, the head of the Emergency Committee of the Catholic Church there, describes for NPR the scene when Pope Francis called every day.
Hundreds of people here in the church, they hear him every day.
More than 500 people took refuge in the compound of the Holy Family Church in Gaza to shelter from the intense Israeli aerial bombardments. When there's enough power, parishioners would project the Pope's video calls onto a big screen.
He's asking us about everything. What do we eat? How is the situation of the water? How is the situation of the health sectors?
UN officials warned in the war between Israel and Hamas that over 500,000 Gazans were one step away from famine. Pope Francis has been outspoken in his criticism of Israel's military campaign in Gaza. Last month, he described the humanitarian situation there as, quote, shameful, and he said there should be an investigation into whether Israel's actions in Gaza constitute genocide.
The wartime was very horrible for us, you know, and it was something that makes us feel like we're facing death every day, but his phones every day makes us feel like we have a father. We have someone who's really protecting us and listening to us through all this mess here in Gaza.
Now there's a ceasefire in Gaza, and Anton says he and all the parishioners there are thinking about their Holy Father.
We love him so much. We have a real father.
They're all praying, he says, that he will get better very soon. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome. This is NPR News.
We continue to mark Black History Month by looking at the impact of Black artists on popular music. Missy Elliott's undeniable legacy next time, here and now.
Did you know you can access the world of public radio? The latest news, standout podcasts, captivating stories, just by speaking? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. What do you think about Texas Fried Chicken? The company once called Kentucky Fried Chicken, now just KFC, is moving its headquarters from Kentucky to Plano, Texas. About 100 people have to change locations. KFC's parent company, Yum Brands, says it wants to bring more of its fast food chains together because Pizza Hut is already based in Plano. Yum Brands itself remains in Kentucky, so I guess they won't make it TFC. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. It's spring training time. Major League Baseball's 30 teams are in Arizona and Florida for the next couple of months preparing for the upcoming season. And this year, for the first time, big league players will be able to challenge calls on balls and strikes. It's all part of a test run to see if some kind of automated strike zone should be in the league's future. Joining us now from Arizona with more is NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan. Good morning, Becky.
Hey, good morning.
Okay, so baseball calls this the automated ball strike challenge system. What does that mean?
Well, first I should just headline that this is just a test for spring training. No matter what, it will not be in effect for the actual 2025 season this year. Okay. Yeah, basically, when an ump makes a call of ball or strike on a pitch, players will be able to challenge if they disagree. There will be a system of cameras set up throughout ballparks to track the exact location of the pitch the moment it passes halfway across home plate. It's a very technical system, same kind of technology you see in tennis and with video replay of offside in soccer.
Oh, okay. How will it work in baseball?
Well, the challenge can only come from three players, either the pitcher, the catcher, or the batter. They have to do it right away, no communication with the dugout. And then everyone in the stadium, the players, the umps, the fans, will all watch on the Jumbotron as this, like, computer-animated version of the pitch will show up, and the system shows whether that was a ball or a strike. And the whole thing takes around just 15 or 20 seconds, and the game moves right along. Teams will start each game with two challenges apiece. If you get one wrong, you lose it. But if you get it right, you keep it. You can keep on challenging. And again, just a test for spring training. It's already been tried out in the minor leagues. But this is a huge change for Major League Baseball to see if it could be added in the 2026 season or beyond.
Now, the other big story in baseball right now is the Los Angeles Dodgers, who won the World Series last season and seem bent on getting their way to another title this year. How much has that come up this week?
I think it's come up even more than this ball strike challenge system we've been talking about. They have been spending big this offseason. They added two of the biggest free agent pitchers in baseball. Those are Blake Snell, the two-time Cy Young winner, and Roki Sasaki, the Japanese phenom who's coming to the U.S. for the first time this season. They also added a new second baseman, a new outfielder, re-signed a bunch of key guys from that World Series run to what is on top of already a star-studded roster with Shohei Ohtani, Mookie Betts, Freddie Freeman. If it sounds like a ton, it is, according to SpotTrack, which is this like contract service. The Dodgers' tax payroll will be nearly $400 million this year, which is double or more than over half the teams in the league and five times as much as the teams at the very bottom.
Hmm. So maybe you can buy yourself a title. Is there a concern about how teams from smaller markets really can keep up with that kind of spending?
Oh, for sure. I mean, especially from fans, but also from other people in baseball. I mean, baseball doesn't have a salary cap. It just has what's called a luxury tax, which is essentially a penalty on payroll that goes over a certain amount. The Dodgers, of course, being way over that amount, but they can afford it. They have a huge market. They have tons of fans. They have a lucrative TV deal. So Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred, he spoke to reporters yesterday, and a lot of the questions he faced were about this concern of competitive balance.
It certainly is at the top of my list of concerns about what's going on in the sport. When I say I can't be critical of the Dodgers, they're doing what the system allows. If I'm going to be critical of something, it's not going to be the Dodgers. It's going to be the system.
But it's not easy to change that system. Players historically haven't wanted anything to limit their income like a salary cap would. So all of that is setting up for a big showdown in union bargaining when the current contract is up after the end of the 2026 season.
That's NPR's Becky Sullivan in Phoenix. Thank you, Becky.
You're welcome. Oh, put me in cold. I'm ready to play
today. Put me in cold. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
The strange relationship between the Social Security system and 1.75 million people dying from the pandemic.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Clear Channel Outdoor, an out-of-home billboard company that offers data-driven advertising solutions for businesses big and small. Billboardsforbusiness.com.
I'm David Brancaccio. We've often explored the perverse fact that disasters can contribute to economic growth even as they destroy security and well-being. Today, a new study that finds the horrors of COVID led to the early deaths of so many people that the Social Security system got a bit stronger. The National Bureau of Economic Research details how Social Security coffers added $205 billion because, this is so grim, because so many people died who would have normally gotten checks. Marketplace's Daniel Ackerman has details.
The early days of the COVID pandemic were really scary, and for good reason, says Hanka Heon-Johnson at the University of Southern California.
So we had a lot of excess deaths. There were 1.7 million excess deaths during the pandemic.
Heon-Johnson co-authored the study, and she says many of those deaths were people who were older than 65.
And were drawing retirement benefits or were going to withdraw retirement benefits, and they had already paid into the system.
They paid in but stopped collecting when they died, and those uncollected funds added up. Gopi Shagoda is with the Brookings Institution, and she says this isn't the first time a public health crisis has left an economic mark on the social safety net.
There is actually an old study about how smoking affects Social Security. Increased rates of smoking reduce the cost to the program because there are premature deaths associated with smoking.
While the COVID study looked specifically at excess deaths, the pandemic impacted Social Security in other ways too. Goda says many people with long COVID drop out of the workforce.
The labor force participation rate directly influences the payroll taxes that are going into Social Security as well.
Overall, Goda says the $205 billion boost to Social Security won't change much in the long term. The government pays that amount in benefits every couple months. I'm Daniel Ackerman for Marketplace.
About 750 workers at the Centers for Disease Control got job termination letters over the weekend. That's about half the 10% layoffs initially expected. And the Washington Post is reporting that the administration is now reversing its plan to shut down the government program that gets free COVID tests to people that would have destroyed millions of test kits. Markets right now, the Dow is down 172 points, 0.4%. The S&P is down 0.1%. The NASDAQ is down 0.2%. Stock market investors got, I think, spoiled with the S&P 500 index up 23% last year. This year, still some records, and there's probably no shame in the S&P being up only 1% over the last month. Some of it is the seismic shifts in policy out of Washington, including announced tariffs, but then uncertainty from the Trump administration on if and when the higher import taxes begin and for whom. For today's Economic Pulse, let's bring in Jared. He's founder of the personal finance site Jared Dillian Money.
I think the stock market is pricing in either a lack of chaos or chaos becoming the new normal. You probably noticed that stocks have quieted down a bit in the last couple of weeks. We had a huge amount of volatility during Trump's first couple of weeks and in the time leading up to that. And since then, the volatility has kind of disappeared from the market. Trump continues to announce tariffs. In the beginning, the tariffs had an enormous market impact. And over time, those announcements of tariffs have resulted in smaller and smaller impacts on the market where now, like, nobody cares.
Jared Dillian is also author of the book called No Worries, How to Live a Stress-Free Financial Life.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals who want to join an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And by the Marketplace newsletter. No jargon, no hype, just smart takes on the economy. Marketplace.org/subscribe.
President Trump's push to end inclusion, fairness, and diversity programs inside and outside the federal government has been met with wide-ranging cooperation from the private sector. Now the NAACP is calling out some of those businesses and asking particularly black consumers to take their purchasing power elsewhere. Marketplace's senior Washington correspondent Kimberly Adams has that.
The NAACP issued a Black Consumer Advisory over the weekend, calling for accountability for the businesses that have rolled back their DEI initiatives and encouraging Black consumers to prioritize shopping in places that are sticking to them.
Black consumers have $1.8 trillion of spending power.
Keisha Bross is Director of Opportunity, Race, and Justice at NAACP. She says the organization is researching and building resources for consumers to track where companies stand.
So what we're saying is you have a choice that you can make in how you choose to use your dollars.
While the NAACP is calling out companies like Meta, Walmart, and McDonald's, Bross says the realities of the economy make it hard for people to avoid some companies altogether. So rather than calling for boycotts, the group wants shoppers to be intentional, which many already are, according to a recent survey from the Harris Poll, which found consumers of all political stripes are already changing their shopping behaviors.
It seems there is a group of consumers that are sort of breaking up with the economy. You know, 43% of them have shifted their spending in the past few months to align with their moral views.
John Gerzema is CEO of the Harris Poll.
That goes up to 66% of Black consumers, 65% of Black women, and even 69% of under 35 Black consumers.
Some shoppers are boycotting stores and products that don't align with their political views, but others are going out of their way to support the companies that do. A boycott. Americus Reed II is a marketing professor at the Wharton School.
Things like boycotts are going to be one of the results that I think are going to shake out with respect to those companies that are actually going to remain true to what they claimed they were in the first place.
Reed predicts we are at the beginning of a larger movement where consumers demonstrate with their wallets that when companies move away from their DEI commitments,
then you're going to pay a long-term price for that with respect to the credibility and authenticity of your brand.
Of course, many of these same companies are facing similar pressure to drop DEI efforts and have to decide which backlash will cost them more. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Murph